From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. As the Obama administration starts a pilot to test the value of college for prison inmates, we listen again to our visit to the men's and women's prisons at Jessup, where Goucher College has professors teaching courses. Then, how can we eat in an ethical way? Tom Hall asks Dr. Ruth Faden of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics about how our eating habits affect our environment. Plus, novelist Laura Lippman tells us why it took her 4 years to figure out how her private investigator heroine could be a responsible mother. And a Baltimore story from Gil Sandler. First, the news.
I'm producer Johnna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. There was news this summer that the Obama administration intends to make Pell Grants to a small number of incarcerated people who will be able to use the money for college courses in prison. Congress banned government grants for prisoners 21 years ago. So when U.S. Education Secretary Arne Duncan and Attorney General Loretta Lynch came to the Maryland Correctional Institute in Jessup 4 weeks ago to unveil the Second Chance Pell pilot program, the move represented a hope that research would prove it's a good deal for taxpayers to pay for prisoners to take college courses. In the spring of 2014, Tom Hall made his own visit to the men's and women's prisons in Jessup and brought us this story about the Goucher Prison Education Partnership.
Both of these forms of politics mobilize ordinary citizens.
Professor Rachel Templer is teaching a class called Understanding Politics. Her students listen intently and quietly jot down notes. 16 women sit in groups of three or four at several large tables that are bathed in sunlight on a crisp April afternoon.
It's within the small issues that they build the power and political recognition that they need to tackle larger issues.
That's Elizabeth.
My name is Elizabeth Starnes, and I'm 43 years old.
Until just a few years ago, Elizabeth had never taken a college course.
I wasn't so bad in elementary and middle school. I failed ninth grade of high school, and I did what I had to do to get by and really had no interest in attending college.
But as of this summer, she's earned 29 college credits.
When I took pre-calculus, I swore up and down that I would not take Calculus 1 because I would cry through the whole thing. And now I'm in Calculus 1. I got 103% on my midterm exam. And now I'm pushing for Calc 2, statistics, anything, math.
Elizabeth was convicted of armed robbery and conspiracy to armed robbery. She told us she's scheduled to be released in 2026.
We have folks serving life sentences or multiple life sentences to those individuals serving 1 year and a day.
That's Margaret Chippendale. She's the warden at the Maryland Correctional Institution for Women. It houses 800 inmates.
The public would have to spend time inside of an institution, particularly an institution such as this, because if they sat down one-on-one with these ladies, they wouldn't know who was an offender and who was a citizen.
There are about 21,000 people in Maryland's prison system. That's how many people live in Cumberland. In the last 35 years, Maryland's prison population has nearly tripled. And Maryland is not alone. According to a Human Rights Watch report released last May, state prison populations have grown more than 240% in the last 29 years.
We're one of the leaders, if not the leader in the world, in terms of the percentage of our population that's incarcerated.
That's Sandy Unger. He was the president of Goucher College until he retired in June. Goucher began the Prison Education Partnership in 2012.
We believe that when we talk about underserved populations, disadvantaged people who are not having equal access to a higher education, one of the primary populations that is neglected is the prison population, the incarcerated population of women and men.
In the 1960s in U.S. prisons, there was a real investment in rehabilitation and also education.
Keramet Ryder is a criminology professor at the University of California, Irvine. She's taught in prisons in New York, California, and Massachusetts. She says the amount of money put into educating inmates has ebbed and flowed over the years. 20 years ago, there is a shift away from investment in prison education programs. That peaked with the passage of a law taking away Pell Grants from prisoners in 1994.
Prior to that, prisoners were eligible if they didn't have any money to their name, which most prisoners don't. They were eligible for financial support to do both correspondence and in-prison college programs. When that support was eliminated in the 90s, a lot of existing programs shut down.
But she says that trend is changing.
I think right now we're in a period of a kind of upswing of reinvestment, both socially and with nonprofits and also government investment in thinking about how education can be put back in prison.
Many prisons have GED programs, but college degree programs have sprung up in prisons as well, including those with a liberal arts focus like Goucher's. They're run by schools like Bard College and Cornell University in New York and Grinnell College in Iowa. Some in the corrections field think that job training and skills-based education is still the best bet for incarcerated people, and that training in a trade will increase their chances of finding employment when they're released from prison. So why offer a liberal arts curriculum to inmates?
They give students the tools they need to go out and finish a college education or apply to graduate school or get further education, as opposed to some of the programs that are more geared towards job skill training, which can be much more limited.
The courses that Goucher offers at Jessup are not a cakewalk.
We're offering statistics, where we may offer pre-calculus.
Amy Rosa is the Goucher Prison Education Partnership's director.
This education that Goucher offers empowers students, whether they're up in Towson or out in Jessup, to be fully engaged politically, socially, and professionally. It's the kind of dynamic education that allows you to really make the most in a changing economy and with changing technology over your lifetime.
A cohort of 70 students are enrolled. The syllabus, the coursework, and the expectations of students are the same in both Towson and Jessup. More than 350 inmates have written letters asking how to apply to the program. That's five times more than the program has room for. And just like the pool of applicants to Goucher in Towson, not all of the students who apply meet the program's qualifications.
We offer a suite of college preparatory classes for students who are not yet ready for rigorous college work. So we'll be offering basic academic writing and either pre-algebra, algebra 1, or algebra 2 in some combination.
Liat Melnick is the program administrator of the partnership.
We're looking for students who have the time. They're actually pretty busy in prison. They have full-time jobs, so people who have the time and the commitment to do this work.
There have been, throughout the 1970s, there were a number of guerrilla groups that were sort of operating on their own, so to speak.
Professor Jeannie Murphy teaches the course on Latin American history at the men's prison in Jessup. Her 10 students consult their textbooks, take notes, and enthusiastically engage in a conversation about politics and power. Their questions and observations are insightful. Their discussion is indistinguishable from the kind of dialogue that you'd expect to hear in any college classroom. Professor Murphy has taught at Goucher College for 7 years. Her first semester at Jessup was last spring.
I had my initial doubts and just thinking, you know, why are they going to care about Latin America? And I was so pleasantly surprised right from day one. I feel almost like a sense of joy that the students have when we're having class.
Teachers in Goucher's program are paid as if they were teaching a course on the Towson campus. This fall, Professor Murphy volunteers as a tutor on Monday nights, and she hopes to be able to add a Spanish class to the curriculum soon. 96% of inmates in Maryland prisons are male. Most are black. The average age is about 37. Like Cedric Nettles, he's a big guy with a bald head and a huge smile. For Professor Murphy's Latin American history class, he wrote a report about the children of the men and women who were disappeared in Argentina in the 1970s and 80s.
How long was it before they started to look into what was going on in different countries, in the other countries?
Pretty much nothing is done until the people who are in power and allowing that to happen lose power.
Cedric was convicted of forgery and fraud. As of this spring, he'd been at Jessup for 3 years, and he says he likely has another 3.5 to go. He's been taking classes through Goucher since 2012.
I've taken pre-algebra, Chinese philosophy, understanding politics, English 103, I'm doing English 104, and Latin American history. the Chinese philosophy and the Latin American history, it's been a real good experience for me.
He showed his paper on the children of the disappeared in Argentina to producer Stephanie Hughes.
What made you choose this topic?
Because I have a fascination with things dealing with children. You know, I'm very sentimental when it comes to children because, you know, I've seen a lot, I've been through a lot as a child myself. So I get very emotional about things with children.
Cedric projects the quiet confidence of a man who knows he's moving forward.
I plan to start my own business once I go home. And if I can get involved with Goucher College or any other college and, you know, get a little bit of business background, you know, or a business major or whatever, then that would also help me to run my business successfully.
None of the funding for the Goucher Prison Education Partnership comes from the state or from the tuition that the students on the Towson campus pay. The inmates' tuition and books are paid for with funding from foundations and individuals who donate specifically to the program. There is evidence to suggest that it's a good investment. Once again, Keramet Ryder, a criminology professor at UC Irvine.
The data is pretty uniform that people who get an education in prison tend to have both lower recidivism rates and higher incomes and employment rates.
Though she cautions that it can be hard to find rigorous studies looking at prison education. After just a couple of years, the Goucher program doesn't yet have data on the outcomes for their students once they get out of prison, but anecdotally, they do well. The students at Jessup cannot yet receive a degree from Goucher College, but they do receive credit for the courses they pass, which appear on a Goucher College transcript. When students are released from prison, they'll be able to transfer their credits to other institutions where they can earn a degree. But for Elizabeth Snarns, who's taking the political science class, it's not just about the degree. It's a matter of engaging in the culture of college and the possibilities an education creates. It's a culture she wishes she had embraced earlier.
I think it would have opened up a completely different social, not just a social aspect for me, but a completely different way of thinking. Knowledge is definitely power, as long as the knowledge is in the right aspect.
The students at Jessup understand what it means to have doors closed on them. And now, they're learning what might happen when some of those doors begin to open.
Tom Hall. He visited the Goucher Prison Education Partnership in Jessup in April 2014. About 70 students will enroll in the program next month. They'll take courses like Spanish, African American history, academic writing, short story writing, introduction to peace studies, and introduction to acting. The Goucher Prison Education Partnership will also continue to offer non-credit college preparatory courses like Algebra 2. Amy Rosa, director of the program, tells us they hope to be one of the sites picked for the Second Chance Pell Grant pilot announced by the Obama administration last month. More information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead, the ethics of food insecurity. Stay with us on 88.1.
If you have thoughts on that segment you just heard, email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now back to the show.
Hi, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. In 25 years, there may be more than 9.5 billion people inhabiting this planet. And keeping everyone fed with safe, nutritious food will be a huge challenge. That challenge will include many thorny ethical issues as we attempt to produce enough good food to satisfy that incredible need. This morning, we're going to revisit a conversation with an acclaimed researcher who approaches the problem of food insecurity from a global perspective. Dr. Ruth Faden is the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics and the co-principal investigator of the Global Food Ethics Project. This is an international team of researchers, ethicists, nutritionists, and people who study a wide variety of areas related to food policy and, in particular, the ethical challenges of feeding an ever-growing human population. Last spring, Dr. Faden's team issued a report called the 7x5 Agenda for Ethics and Global Food Security, which suggests 7 projects that can be undertaken in the next 5 years to address the complex issues around global food security. When we talked here on Maryland Morning in early June, she joined me on the phone from Massachusetts, and we began by talking about why food security must be viewed as an ethical issue.
It's pretty straightforward, actually, Tom. When you start thinking at all about how we can feed, as you say, as much as 9.5 billion people, the answers, as you start to think about them, all raise kind of trade-offs between values. So to give you a quick example, it's a pretty straightforward thing to raise enough food to feed everybody if we don't care about the impact of how we produce that food on the environment. But we do care, right? So one ethical challenge is how to strike the balance between protecting the environment in a context of climate change and producing enough food. It would also be an easy trick, maybe not an easy trick, but more straightforward, to produce enough food if we were indifferent to the impact of how we raise that food on, for example, the farm workers and farmers whose labor produces the food. So if we were indifferent to farm standards and worker protection, we could pretty quickly get enough food. Similarly, if we were indifferent to animal welfare, if we didn't care at all about how it is that livestock are treated, we'd probably be okay as well. So this is just to illustrate that once you start thinking at all hard about how it is, in fact, that we will get to this goal, this moral imperative of global food security, we realize that we've got to make some very ethically challenging trade-offs.
And it's a fascinating endeavor to think about what those challenges are. And I found that the 7 projects that you're suggesting are really quite fascinating. The one that sticks out to me in a big way is the ethics of meat consumption,
yes,
particularly in high-income and middle-income countries. So how much meat we consume as a species, how does that impact these ethical decisions that we've got to make?
So there's been a controversy for a long time, and almost, I would imagine, many of our listeners right now are either vegetarians or vegans, or have friends who are vegetarians and vegans and have been involved in many dining room table conversations about, is it ethically okay to eat meat? That is to say, is it all right to kill another animal in order that we as a species enjoy a better meal or a more nutritious one? That debate is probably not one that is resolvable. That is to say, people have very deep views about the ethics of whether it's appropriate to eat non-human animals. And we might leave it as an unresolved debate, except for one thing. Eating meat is not only ethically controversial from the standpoint of the rights and interests of the animals we are eating, but it also has a profound impact on the environment. It turns out that the pace at which we currently eat meat and dairy, I have to throw dairy in here as well, produces more greenhouse gases than all of the transportation sector combined. That is, you could take all the emissions from vehicles on the road, airplanes, boats, combine them all up together, and the impact in terms of greenhouse gases doesn't come close to the impact that the livestock production results in. Most of us don't appreciate that. We've all been, I think, well-educated or informed about the impact of the transportation sector. We've had all this focus on fuel-efficient cars and carbon sequestering in that sector, but not when it comes to the eating of meat and dairy.
And Americans account for an awful lot of the consumption of meat and dairy, about 4.5% of the world's population, but we're eating 15% of the meat. So this is a particularly germane issue,
yes,
for our country and our public policy.
Yes, absolutely. That's correct. We are huge consumers of meat and dairy, and you know, meat and dairy tastes good.
And your project then would concern what then? You wish to shape the conversation about this. What do you hope to achieve in this particular aspect of your suggestions?
What we want to do in this project is put to the side, for purposes of expanding public conversation, this controversy about the ethics of eating meat, and instead focus on two other important values where there's more consensus. One is human health. So how much of what kinds of meat and dairy products should we be eating in order to have optimum nutrition? And that's a hugely debatable and controversial area right there. And then also, how should we think about what we can do to reduce meat consumption once we figure out how much meat and dairy people at different points in the life cycle should have for good nutrition? And some people will argue that zero, and other people will argue, no, there is a place for meat and dairy in the diet. Once we figure that out, then we can take that and we can look at it in terms of the kinds of impacts on climate change and the environment that we've just been discussing and determine what our target should be. So once we know what the target consumption rate should be for meat and dairy, taking both health and environmental impact into consideration, then we have to think about the ethics of what we can do to moderate or influence people's consumption of meat and dairy so we get closer to that target range.
Dr. Ruth Faden from the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. She led a team of researchers who published a list of 7 proposals to address ethical issues related to global food security. On Maryland Morning, I'm Tom Hall. Dr. Faden and I spoke in June. One of the 7 projects involves labeling. What do labels like organic or fair trade or certified humane really mean? Dr. Faden thinks that labels like these need to be codified in a more accurate way.
So some of these labels are terrific. They stand for or reflect very carefully researched operations that are quite serious and reliable and clear about what they're vouchsafing. Others, not so much. And most products that you might be interested in buying or most foods that you'd be interested in buying will have some, but not all. So some would have the USDA organic on it. Some might say fair trade certified. Some might say environmentally friendly, but you can't get it all at once. What we're proposing is essentially to create a mega system, if you like, of certifications and labels that would be kind of one-stop shopping for the consumer so that I could go to my supermarket, whether it's a big box store or it's a boutique, and I would be able to look at a product, pick it up, hold it, and be able to see with one glance where the product stood on a range of ethical values, food safety, sustainable farming practices, that would be the environment, labor standards, animal welfare would be the principal ones. And what we are proposing here is not to replace the certification and labeling that is currently working well, but to aggregate them in a way to make it easier for the consumer, and also where the labels are not so accurate or not so clear, to replace them. And if we really are successful, what we're envisioning is a way in which you could scan the product and be able to see the breakdown. So if I'm really interested in labor standards and want to make sure that it's all fair trade and that there's no child labor involved in this product, I can see that. If I'm interested in animal welfare practices, I can see that. If I'm interested in food safety, I'll be able to see that disaggregated with a sort of scan with my smartphone.
One of the projects has to do with climate smart agriculture that is also climate just. And in the report, you make the point that in tropical regions, for example, the places that are most often hit by droughts and extreme weather events, they have a huge need for climate smart agriculture. But to be climate smart and climate just is often difficult for people in less affluent circumstances. What is the distinction between climate smart and climate just?
It's a very critical distinction from our point of view. So it's extremely exciting that over the past year or so, this language of climate smart agriculture has taken on a life of its own. It represents, in fact, an international agreement that came out in 2014, sponsored by the United Nations, that is a commitment on the part of a significant number of nations across the world and many more organizations to work together to try to develop more aggressively, more rapidly, new technologies in farming and agricultural practices that are both kinder to the environment, that will have less of a negative impact on the environment, and that are also adaptive, more adaptive to the changes of in our climate that are sadly inevitable. So this is all great. This is all really, really good. It's important, very, very important, that we find better ways to both adapt agricultural practices to our changing climate and also do what we can to mitigate the impact of the agricultural sector on climate change. The problem about the difference between climate smart and climate just is recognizing that the impact of climate change on the world is not distributed evenly, that there are parts of the world where the burden of climate change now and in the future will fall most heavily on the world's most disadvantaged farmers and the world's poorest people who rely on those farmers heavily for their basic survival. So if you think about where people are poorest in the world, that's where climate change is going to be the most destructive. The areas that hug around the equator, especially, for example, huge swaths of Africa. What we need to do to make climate smart, climate just, is ensure that the benefits of these new technologies will be experienced by the world's most disadvantaged farmers, and also that they will be able to afford them and that they will be the right kinds of technologies that will help them in their particular circumstances. So it's not as if climate change is going to affect all food producers equally. It will hit hardest the people who always suffer the most, which is the world's most disadvantaged.
Dr. Ruth Faden is the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics and a professor of biomedical ethics at Hopkins. She is the co-principal investigator of the Global Food Ethics Project, which released an agenda for global food security last May. She and I spoke last spring. We've got a link to the report and more on the seven projects the report recommends, as well as a link to blog posts with more information if you'd like to explore this subject further. Come on over to wipr.org/Maryland Morning. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Lots more coming up. Stay with us.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wipr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wipr.org/Maryland Morning.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. As a novelist, Laura Lippman keeps a pace like the tempo she set meeting deadlines as a reporter for the Baltimore Sun. Lippman has published 21 novels in 18 years. But there was a curious gap in her signature series, the mysteries built around reporter-turned-private investigator Tess Monahan. Until last spring, we hadn't gotten a peek at Tess since 2011, when she was solving a mystery while on bed rest for a difficult pregnancy. Roughly the same time Tess became a mother, Lippman did too in real life. I sat down with Lippman last February when she published her 12th Tess Monahan mystery called Hush Hush. I asked whether motherhood had had something to do with the gap in the Tess list.
Tess's motherhood has something to do with it. The story of the girl in the green raincoat, while it was published 4 years ago as a novella, originally appeared as a serial in the New York Times starting in 2008. Mm-hmm. So it's actually taken me that long to come back to Tess. There is one short story on the side a couple of years ago that was the beginning of me grappling with the idea of Tess as a mother.
Why is that so hard?
The form in which I write demands a certain level of suspense, of risk for the main character. And I felt that a lot of readers would be troubled by a mother, specifically a mother, more so than a father, who took risk when she had a small child at home. Now, I teach writing every January. I take a week, and I teach in this fabulous writers' conference down at Eckerd College in St. Petersburg, Florida. I just finished my 10th year down there. And over the years, I had found myself telling my students that sometimes when you have a problem and you're trying to write around it, you produce something that's very disingenuous and fake. The problem, in a weird way, might be the solution. The thing you're trying to get away from might be the thing that you need to run straight toward. So instead of trying to devise a Tess Monahan mystery in which the child is off to the side and I try to pretend it's not an issue, I decided to make it the issue, to make parenthood, motherhood, the focus of this book, and to see what happened if I gave Tess a troubling case involving another mother, and B, just showed what it was like for her day to day trying to be a parent while having this job. And she is trying to be cautious and thoughtful and pragmatic and down to earth. She is not trying to put herself at risk in any way. But as Tess Monahan discovers, sometimes risk can find you anyway, even when you're doing the right things.
Okay, so listening to that, somebody would think, oh, this is a book about a mother. This is a very complicated mother.
Well, the mother that Tess Monahan has gone to work for, I believe at one point she says that she's every woman's nightmare, and she is. I should give credit.
Melisandre Harris-Dawes is her name.
This was inspired by a long-ago comment by someone who has been very good to me over the years, Anna Quinlan. Anna Quinlan.
The columnist for the New York Times.
Yes, the columnist for the New York Times and Newsweek, novelist, terrific novelist. I believe she was writing for Newsweek when the Andrea Yates case happened, in which a woman in Texas killed all five of her children, a woman who was finally found to have been mentally ill at the time and was given a sentence on her second trial of not guilty by reason of insanity. And Anna Quinlan told this very moving story about one of the most difficult times when her three children were young, and how frustrated and anxious and overmatched she felt by the situation. And she went on to say that most mothers, specifically mothers, in their heart of hearts, when they hear a story such as the Yates story, if they're being really honest, it resonates with them, that they don't 100% recoil in horror and go, oh my God, how could that happen? That actually they understand that if you're mentally ill and dealing with problems like this, it could happen. That it's almost surprising it doesn't happen more often sometimes.
That's Laura Lippman here on Maryland Morning, WYPR, talking last spring about her newest Tess Monahan mystery, Hush Hush.
And that really stuck with me, and I thought it was fascinating. And I began doing some research into Yates. And I quickly found out that when she did win, she didn't win her freedom, but she at least had her criminal conviction overturned and is institutionalized to this day. Her roommate at the psychiatric facility where she was sent had also killed a child, really horribly. I don't like to talk about it. It's very disturbing. Let's just say she killed her infant child. And she was released. She did however much time she did, and she went back to the Texas town where she was from, and she got a job at Walmart. And the local TV station decided to make that a news story. You know, child killer is now greeter at Walmart. She might not have been a greeter, but at any rate,
something like that.
People began flocking to see her. Like she was a freak in some modern day freak show. And, you know, Walmart is not the villain here. They regretfully told her that she could not continue working there because of the disturbance. I was so moved by that story. The idea of, okay, you're already trying to come back from pretty much the worst thing I can imagine. That you've killed your child. It doesn't, you know, yes, you were mentally ill. Yes, it really wasn't you who did it, but you've already got to overcome that. And now you can't even have this little corner of privacy. But as I often do when I'm thinking about something, I think, okay, now let's flip it. What happens if a woman who's done this invites the attention, wants the attention, is powerful in the way that you're powerful if you have money and standing? What if she forces us as a society to have the conversation? And that's where Melisandre came from. A woman who 10 years out has decided, I want to talk about what happened to me. I want to tell my story. I want other women to admit that I'm not a monster, that I'm not someone who can be written off, that I'm human, and that what I did could happen to a lot of people.
And so she commissions a documentary, and on page one, we are plunged immediately into the transcript of an interview that's being done for this documentary. You're married to writer and producer David Simon. I'm envisioning that there was some point where you were on some movie set or TV set where you thought, now that would be a good technique to clue readers into points they need to know about the fact. I can pull them into these interviews.
You know, I think the reason I decided to use the documentary format is because I really like documentaries. And also, to be really honest, I like some reality TV. And I've become really conscious about the way that reality TV does sometimes cast a shadow on more serious documentary work. I mean, that's a theme I have a lot of fun with in the book, where poor Harmony, the director of this very serious documentary about which she already has ethical qualms, is constantly explaining to people, this is not a reality show. You know, she goes about getting her releases and clearances. She has to keep explaining to people about what she does. So no, I think it just came out of my own real and very genuine affection for documentary. And, you know, probably my reporter past.
Laura Lippman, her latest novel, published last spring, is a Tess Monahan mystery called Hush Hush, out in paperback next week. Lippman has won several more awards since we spoke in February, and 4 weeks from Sunday, she'll be speaking about Hush Hush at the Baltimore Book Festival. I'm Sheila Cast. Maryland Morning is an original production
of Your Public Radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Johnna McCone
and Connor Graham.
We have production help from
Christy Forrest
and Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. On the web at ZEKESCoffee.com.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in Maryland history, 1963, the Gwynne Oak Amusement Park in Woodlawn was desegregated. Baltimore County Executive Spiro Agnew negotiated a desegregation agreement with the park's private owners 6 weeks after hundreds of black and white protesters had been arrested for defying segregation rules. We're back Monday. Please join us.